Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the elections today in Canada that will decide whether incumbent Prime Minister Stephen Harper will get a fourth term or whether Justin Trudeau, the son of a former Prime Minister, will lead his Liberal Party to victory, ending a 10-year stretch of Conservative rule in Canada. Claire Pascal, a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal's Centre for International Studies, joins us to discuss why the Canadian left and centre-left are split between the New Democratic Party and the Liberal Party, thus giving the Conservatives an easy electoral advantage. Then, on the day that the United States Congress returns to work, we will speak with Edward Kleinbard, a visiting professor of law at Stanford University who served as chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. Since the government will run out of money in early November, we will discuss Ed's article, Our Debt Ceiling Nightmare, and look into the much more serious implications of a debt ceiling crisis as opposed to a shutdown of the government that only calls into question our ability to govern ourselves. Because when our government dishonors its financial obligations, a global financial and economic crisis is triggered, inflicting permanent damage on the dollar as a global reserve currency. And finally, we'll examine the foiled attempt by the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime to get countries to consider decriminalizing the possession and use of all drugs, a proposal that was withdrawn after pressure from a powerful member nation, likely the United States. Steve Rolls, a senior policy analyst at the Transform Drug Policy Foundation in the UK, joins us to discuss efforts to change governmental drug policies ahead of a meeting of the world drug problem at the United Nations General Assembly next April. And joining us now is Claire Pascal, who is a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal's Centre for International Studies. She's also a Fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs in Chatham House, London, a consultant for the United States Department of Energy, NATO and the OSCE, and was a recipient of the Award of Special Merit from the Grantham Prize for her book, Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Welcome to Background Briefing, Claire Pascal.
A pleasure, thanks.
And this 78-day campaign, I have to laugh, Claire, because, you know, we're more than a year out and we're just absolutely bombarded with elections and debates. And the idea that a 78-day campaign was the longest in 140 years of Canadian history seems to me to be certainly something that's tolerable, shall we say, rather than some kind of peculiar historical statistic, but I guess it's still too early, right? The polls don't close for another couple of hours. You're there in Montreal looking at the results. Is there anything you can tell us?
Well, the early results are coming in from the East Coast. So Canada has several time zones, and the East Coast polls have closed, so we're getting results as they come in across the country. The early results from the East are just over 20 seats for the Liberals, one for the Conservatives, one for the NDP. We have a long way to go. It's 170 seats for a majority government, a total number of seats in the Parliament of 338. And these are traditionally more Liberal Party parts of the country. But so far it doesn't seem like there's any huge upset, but there does seem to be momentum behind the Liberal Party.
And isn't it a little odd, though, that you've got the Conservatives have played the race card, if you will, over the hijab, the chadoro, apparently in Quebec, in particular, people are showing up the polls wearing Halloween masks to sort of satirize it, and it would seem that the Conservatives, by playing that card, are having more traction in the more liberal east of the country, in Quebec in particular.
Yeah, well, it was interesting, actually. That happened when I was voting today. There were two women, one of whom was wearing a Skeletor mask, who showed up to vote and demanded her right to vote without uncovering her face. And there was a long discussion about it with the returning officer. And the returning officer said, look, you're creating a big long line behind you. And the people in the line said, we're fine with it. So, it is a very touchy issue. It's a really hot button issue. But even that person, I don't think necessarily was voting conservative. So I'm not, the Conservative Party are the only ones, apart from the nationalist Quebecois Party, that have taken on this niqab issue. So it is a hot-button issue. I'm not sure if it's going to translate into votes, but it has definitely stirred up a really vitriolic discussion. My returning officer, when I handed in my paper, there were some women coming in burqas. So the niqab, you see the eyes. The burqa, what they were wearing, you don't see anything. And my returning officer, as she was handing me the voting paper, was saying very loudly about how these people shouldn't come here and they don't want to respect the Canadian ways and all that sort of stuff. So this is that door has been opened now. So we'll see whether it translates into votes, but whether or not it translates into votes, it's something Canada is going to have to be dealing with for quite a while.
But it's pretty clear that that Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister for the last 10 years, has been stoking Islamophobia, hasn't he, with this barbaric cultural practices law that they've pushed?
Yeah, I mean, the law is Stephen Harper proposed an act to outlaw. The name of the act refers to barbaric cultural practices. Everything that's in the law is already illegal. Things like the so-called honor killings. It's already illegal to kill people. So there is that whipping up of that sort of sentiment. There is, at the same time, some very serious problems within the community. And, you know, moderate Muslims are among the loudest voices talking about this problem. We had a case in Quebec not that long ago where a father and his second wife killed his first wife and three daughters. I mean, there's some horrific examples, but they are just examples. The question is, you know, is this something that you want to use to tar an entire society with, an entire part of your society with, or do you want to start to deal with just those extreme elements? And that's where that line is becoming increasingly blurred and potentially very problematic.
And if we're talking about pettiness here, which I think I think that's a fair category, if you're just going after, doing a dog whistle attack on Islamophobia, Harper also took away the voting rights of 1.4 million Canadians living abroad. It's got some of the people here in Hollywood, like Donald Sutherland, really riled up.
Well, that's an interesting constitutional question. It's for people who have been non-resident in Canada for over 5 years. So the question is, you know, are you still Canadian? If you don't pay tax, if you're not living in the country and imbibing the debate on a daily basis, can you still vote? And it's a very interesting question, and it's one worth debating. I mean, I'm sure there was a very shrewd political calculation behind that specifically.
The Liberals abroad that you'd be cutting down their numbers, right?
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. Right. And because Canada is changing very quickly, and we have, you know, there are these extreme examples of violent Islam coming out of Canada and heading towards the States. Quebec has been a soft entry point for Islamic extremists because of the language law linkages to our immigration policy. So if you are, Quebec prioritizes French-speaking immigrants. So if you are a 30-year-old Moroccan with five children, you'll take precedence over an English-speaking PhD holder from the UK, just because they want to pump up the numbers of French speakers in Quebec. And that's resulted in cases like, you know, the guy from Montreal who went and tried to blow up LAX. So we've had, we have very specific, complex issues that really do need to be addressed. I'm not sure whether the dog whistle stuff will do it, but there are some other issues related to extreme violent Islam that definitely have to be addressed. There was a firebombing of a Jewish school. There's been desecration of cemeteries. I mean, it's something is happening. Bringing it into the election in this way may or may not be beneficial. The election is still ongoing, and so as a Canadian, I'm not really supposed to tell people which way to vote.
Can I tell them?
No, actually, it's illegal for you. Foreigners are not allowed to try to influence the Canadian election in any way.
Right. I saw the John Oliver's piece on HBO. It was hilarious, ending up with Mike Myers dressed as a as a Mountie.
That's right, and it might be illegal for him as well, because non-resident Canadians aren't allowed to try to influence the election either. And that, again, Canada is very, very different from the U.S. So John Oliver sort of presented that as a ridiculous law, but what that means is, for example, the Koch brothers can't pump money into a Canadian election.
Ah, I see. Well, then there is a good side to it. So let's talk about the issue, of course, that crosses the border, and that's the Keystone XL pipeline, yep. Which the Obama administration recently vetoed a Republican effort to fast-track it. And I believe that all parties support it, don't they?
To some degree or another, not necessarily the NDP, which is kind of the more left. Now, the problem that this election has had, and you alluded to it in the introduction, is the Conservatives are very clear that, you know, they're... Stephen Harper has a master's in economics. He's a very traditional economy focused, relatively right party. And traditionally, the Liberals have been in the middle; they've been very centrist, and the NDP have been to the left. But there's been a lot of switching back and forth of position between the NDP and the Liberals. So the Liberals have said they're willing to run a deficit for 3 years. The NDP has said they're going to balance the books, which essentially means austerity. So there's a lot of the kind of center and left has become very confused. So especially kind of on issues like this, like Keystone, it's not easily predictable, which is why this has been a very difficult election for a lot of Canadians. What's going to be kind of the biggest impact on oil sands development in Canada is the price of oil. The drop in the price of oil has kicked the bottom out of the Canadian economy. Our dollar has dropped dramatically. It's a good time for American tourists to come up and visit Canada. Our dollar's worth, you know, kind of 80% less than yours. But what it's also meant is with an NDP government being elected in Alberta, which is the main oil province within Canada, there's been a real throttling back on the development of the oil sector within Canada. So just straightforward economic reasons, I think you'll see a lot less interest in pushing forward on the policy.
So just to sort of translate these two parties on the center-left and left, the NDP and the Liberals being the center-left, clearly by splitting the left, they've given the Conservatives an easy ride in the last couple of elections, and it's a bit mystifying why they can't form a coalition. And I think this time around, the NDP leader, by the way, I think the guy should have a shave. he just doesn't look good with that sort of translucent beard that he's got. But in any case, the split is pretty clear. This time around, the NDP said that they would form a coalition. So just walk us through. Would that be like the NDP would be like the Bernie Sanders wing? Not that Bernie is actually a Democrat, but he's running as a Democrat. And the Liberal Party are just the Democrats who are pretty much centrist nowadays.
Normally, that would be the case. Mulcair, who is the leader of the New Democrats himself, used to be a member of the Liberal Party. So he's, I'd say, much more on the right wing of the left, so to speak. And he is, for example, calling for a balanced budget as opposed to calling for stimulus in the economy. So for U.S. listeners, though, who may not be familiar with the Canadian parliamentary system, you don't vote for the leader, you vote for your local MP, and then the party with the most number of local MPs elected, the leader of that party becomes the prime minister. So I don't, you will get people voting on local issues that have nothing to do with who they want as prime minister. So you can end up with, because of this three-way race, you can end up with one government that has two parties involved in it, like the British did in their last parliament. So you can have in this case, if nobody gets a majority, say the Liberals and the NDP can combine their seats and divide up the cabinet portfolios and share the government. That would be a coalition government.
But they didn't do that a few years back.
They didn't do that, and some people think that was a mistake. And I think that at the time they didn't think that the Conservatives would come back quite so strong and win a majority the next time around. If you win a majority, if you have 170 out of the 338 seats, you own the government.
Right.
And that's what happened in the last time. There's no separation between, you know, you hold the House and you hold the Senate and the Prime Minister, the President's from a separate party. You know, if you own the House, you own the Prime Ministership. So you can get a lot of policy throughs. And part of the, you know, there are a lot of these touchstone issues that have really affected this election. And one of the objections to the Harper government was the actual destruction of fisheries and oceans, research libraries, a real gutting of research and innovation facilities, a very kind of anti-knowledge-based environmental policy. And that's touched a lot of people. Mm-hmm. That's been one big issue. Another issue has been that the government hasn't taken the disappearance and murder of Aboriginal women seriously. Over 1,000 Aboriginal women in Canada have disappeared, presumably murdered. And there's been no national-level investigation into what's going on. And that's, again, been a touchstone issue for a lot of people. So they want to see a change of government just based on those two policies in many cases, or one of the two policies in many cases, but they're unsure whether to vote NDP or to vote Liberal Party. And so you're getting a lot of strategic voting, people vote swapping, saying the Liberal in my riding has more chance and the NDP guy in your riding has more chance, so you vote for NDP in your riding and I'll vote for Liberal in mine. Anybody but Harper.
And of course, Trudeau, the son of a former Prime Minister, who is he's actually relatively young. I've seen some videos of him that don't do him any favors as a young performer. He was a drama teacher. The ads against him have been quite sort of patronizing about his so-called lack of experience. They keep calling him Justin. I think they're almost implying he's Justin Bieber, who I guess is the most popular Canadian on the planet, according to his Twitter followers, something like 70 million Twitter followers. But then in desperation, Harper then has to hang out with the two Ford brothers, one of whom is this corpulent cocaine snorter. So the whole thing is a little bit comical, isn't it?
Well, it's gone. I mean, clearly the Conservative campaign went off the rails at some point. And in fact, one of his chief campaign strategists was sent home about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Something has, the wheels to some degree have come off the bus. And I think he may have miscalculated by making it such a long election period, because it gave the other parties time to put their narrative together and consolidate the votes. And for Canadians who are so inclined to do more strategic voting or targeted get-out-the-vote type campaigns. So it might be that over 70 days is too long for a Canadian election.
Right. Well, I salute you and your countrymen. Just in closing then, Cleo, the back to Keystone. I mean, they all support it in degrees. And Trudeau is saying that he supports it, but he wants to have a better relationship with the United States. And I guess that's what they're sort of trying to run on, the extent to which I take it Harper and Obama don't get on that well.
They may not get on that well, but Canada and the U.S. are extremely close. I mean, there's just been an announcement that, you know, we might be forming a joint military unit.
Right.
You know, we are very tight at the hip. And Canada benefits enormously from being under the U.S. strategic and defense umbrella.
Right, so, but that's what Justin Trudeau is pushing, isn't he? Saying, I'll be a better friend of America than Harper is.
I don't know how he could be, but yeah. And the other big question is going to be what happens with the TPP.
Right.
If somebody other than Harper comes in, will the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal be ratified?
Well, it's not looking good at this end, I can tell you.
Yeah. So this is an important election for Canada and an important election, as you say, for U.S.-Canada relations going forward.
Right. But every day, the Canadian tar sands oil does cross the United States in rail cars that are very dangerous. You had that explosion in Quebec.
Yeah.
So it's sort of an odd argument in many ways that, you know, the people that want the pipeline can actually make the case that it's safer than it is under the current situation where they're shipping it by rail.
Yeah, they could, except there's an increasing number of problems with the pipelines as well.
Of course, we could do a whole program on that. I'm not endorsing the pipeline. I'm just saying that it's not exactly a clear-cut argument that's been given on either side.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And also the question, I mean, within Canada, the discussion is whether it will be a north-south pipeline, or if that's blocked and oil prices go higher, will it just go to the west? Will it just go to the west coast and get, right, you know, put on ships and go out to Asia?
Sure. Well, Cleo Pascal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Cleo Pascal, who's a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, and a consultant to the US Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. She was the recipient of the Award of Special Merit from the Grantham Prize for her book, Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the approaching debt ceiling nightmare. And joining us now is Edward Kleinbart, who is a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law and currently a visiting professor of law at Stanford University. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. Before joining USC Law, he served as the chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. And his latest book is We Are Better Than This: How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he just wrote the article, Our Debt Ceiling Nightmare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Kleinbart.
Ian, thank you very much for having me.
And Ed, the Congress came back to work today. And of course, they don't have a speaker, and there's some doubt as to when they will have a speaker. And there's obviously a civil war within the Republican Party that has a majority going on. So we're not quite sure of where that stands. But there is obviously a confusion, which you've tried to clarify in your article, our debt ceiling nightmare, between the shutdown of the government and the debt ceiling crisis, which will hit us early in November, which is only a couple of weeks away. So let's go through the difference. I mean, it's as bad as it is that that we shut down the government, which would indicate that we are incapable of governing ourselves. That should be embarrassing enough. But what you're arguing is that a debt ceiling crisis is far, far more damaging to the United States.
That's right, Ian. You know, look, we have muddled through a couple of government shutdowns over the last couple of decades, and they are embarrassing. They are outrageous. They randomly destroy economic value by making government, in effect, go home and then not be able to conduct the ordinary course of business. And so when they return, notwithstanding people's jokes that, you know, that we're all better if there is no government, that's just not true. We need an SEC. We need a functioning IRS. We need a functioning judiciary and so on. And government shutdowns just take value away from all of us and embarrass us in front of the rest of the world and demonstrate our inability to govern ourselves, as you said. But in the end, we can muddle through for a week or two, and it means that you can't visit a national park or you can't get a passport. But in the end, life lurches back into gear. Debt ceiling crisis is different. We have never, in fact, in the 226 years history of the Republic, we have never had an occasion on which the government of the United States has stood up and systematically dishonored its financial obligations. That's what a debt ceiling crisis is. It's saying we will not pay our financial obligations. And that includes all forms of financial obligations, not just treasury bonds, not just Social Security payments, but everything, rent to a landlord who's leasing property to the U.S. government, military salaries for our men and women in service, salaries for every federal employee, every financial disbursement by the government of the United States would, in a sense, now be called into question because the Treasury Department would not have the resources, would not be permitted by the Congress to borrow the funds necessary to pay those bills, notwithstanding the fact that the markets are wide open and perfectly delighted to lend us the money to pay our bills, just as we've done year after year for the last several decades.
But that's where you have this economic illiteracy on the part of the hardliners in the Congress, the so-called Freedom Caucus or the Tea Party. They don't seem to understand that this is a perfectly reasonable, pragmatic way to run a government. They have turned it into some sort of economic fundamentalism of some kind. Yeah. And I don't understand why they can't be educated as to what that their objections to raising the debt ceiling have nothing to do with the deficit, but that's what they think it is. Try to explain to our audience what these people think, why they put this government at such risk and destroy the full faith and credit of the United States government and devalue one of America's greatest economic assets, which is that the dollar is the global reserve currency, and they're prepared to put that in jeopardy. So explain it, if you will, what their thinking is.
Well, it's difficult to explain for certain the thinking of people who are acting irrationally, but I think there are a couple of different strains at work. One is that some members, I believe, frankly, don't understand that a debt ceiling crisis is not the same as shutting down government. Shutting down government means that Congress has chosen not to legislate the funds necessary to keep government open. Debt ceiling crisis means that Congress has appropriated the necessary money, but has not given the Treasury the authority to go out and borrow it to pay our bills. So a debt ceiling crisis is a backwards-looking moment. It's saying we've incurred expenses because Congress has directed us to. We have not collected enough tax revenues because Congress has set our tax revenues. And therefore, we have done everything that Congress has demanded, as a result of which there are deficits, which, by the way, have come way down. But as a result of which there are deficits, deficits must be funded by borrowing. And then Congress says, we refuse to authorize the very borrowing that our policies, the Congress's policies, have demanded of you. And so I think many members in the Freedom Party have this odd idea that somehow this is the president's fault or this is the way to force him to cut spending. But at every turn, these are congressional policies that we're talking about. Congress is the one who enacts spending legislation, only Congress. The executive, the president, must spend whatever Congress appropriates. The president has no discretion in that matter, and the president cannot spend what Congress doesn't appropriate. The president can't raise taxes on his own. Only Congress sets tax rates, and the president and the Treasury Department cannot borrow to fund any deficits without Congress directly authorizing those borrowings. That's the constitutional framework of this country. So that's one motive. And the other is simply that people have this idea that they can control the crisis, that they can set off a nuclear bomb, but somehow direct the blast so as not to be terribly inconvenient for most Americans. But that's just nonsense. This literally is like setting off a gigantic bomb and thinking that you can control the resulting shockwave. It will fundamentally alter the role of the United States in the global economy. It will fundamentally alter the value of the dollar in the global economy. It will cost us billions of dollars a year more to fund the national government. All for what? Because some members of Congress want to short-circuit the regular order. The regular order is a phrase they love, but what they really want to do is to short-circuit the regular order, to say there are political agendas that they have, for example, defunding Planned Parenthood, that they for which they do not have the votes. And so they say, here at last, we have an opportunity to take a grenade, pull the pin out, and say, give us what we want, or we'll blow us and you alike up. And that is, I think, a fundamentally immoral act. If you in fact, don't have the votes to defund Planned Parenthood or whatever the objective of the moment is, then you don't have the votes. So you don't dishonor the debts that you've incurred as a way of trying to force the votes. And the last point, Ian, there's this idea that Congress can as I say, deflect the blast from most Americans by enacting prioritization legislation. Congress will say, well, Treasury has some money coming in, so Treasury is hereby directed to pay national debt first and Social Security second, and so on. And the problem with that is it's probably unconstitutional because all of the anybody to whom the federal government owes money has a full faith and credit promise of the government that that money will be paid. There's no constitutional basis for a senior claim on government assets. And it's unadministrable because the Treasury payment systems just aren't set up that way. The Treasury payment systems do distinguish between debt service and everything else. But within the world of everything else, the payment systems are very simple. Bill comes in, Treasury pays it. And the systems themselves have no way of distinguishing whether they're paying a Social Security check to Ian Masters or a rent bill or the salary of a government employee or anything else. So the idea that we're going to deflect the blast from most Americans by enacting prioritization legislation, probably unconstitutional and certainly unadministrable, just literally cannot be done.
So where is the adult in the room here? Obviously, the Tea Party, the Freedom Caucus, drove out or basically drove Boehner to despair and he quit. Is there any way that they can be educated before they pull the pin out of the grenade and toss it?
No. Actually, I don't think that there is. I think, you know, the hope in Washington is that Mr. Boehner, on his way out the door, will say, well, what do I have to lose? And he and a handful of Republicans will cross party lines, join with Democrats, and pass a simple, clean debt ceiling bill increasing the borrowing capacity of the Treasury. That's certainly a possibility, but one has to recognize that first you have to have 30 Republicans at a minimum cross the line, party lines, to make that work. While Mr. Boehner may be willing to, it's not clear that 29 others will necessarily follow. Second, it's not clear that he himself will be in a position to or willing to. Why are we literally putting uncountable billions of dollars of risk, you know, to destroy, as you said earlier, one of the great storehouses of value of the United States, because some people can't get their way in Congress because they don't have the votes to do what they want to do? You know, that is, an immoral and an immature act. Let's hope that Mr. Boehner can somehow find 29 other Republicans to join with him to cross the aisle for this purpose. But it's by no means a foregone conclusion, and I'm not sure which other adult's going to leap to the into that void. Paul Ryan could do it. He's a highly intelligent man. He understands everything I've said, and then some. But he has long-term political ambitions. I don't know if he's willing to put, he's a young man as well, if he's willing to put all of that at risk in this context.
Well, but just in closing, though, Ed Kleinbart, if you can't get the votes, if Boehner couldn't get the votes to join with Pelosi and stop this madness, it probably indicates that it's the entire Republican electorate that has to be educated along with these Tea Party people, because that's what they're probably playing on, is the election fears that you're going to be, people are going to run against you as the guy that
you
sold out.
Exactly.
Yeah, you get primaried. Well, Ed, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Ian. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Edward Kleinbart, who is a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law and currently a visiting professor of law at Stanford University. And his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he just wrote the article, Our Debt Ceiling Nightmare. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into a foiled attempt at the United Nations to decriminalize drugs.
Outside the passion, millions put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from the UK is Steve Rolls, who's a senior policy analyst at the Transform Drug Policy Foundation, where he is the lead author on many of their publications, including 2009's After the War on Drugs, Blueprint for Regulation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Rolls.
Hi there.
And you, an official, attempted to get a number of countries to decriminalize the possession and use of all drugs. This has apparently been foiled. I'm not entirely sure why. But then there are other reports saying that this official was acting above her pay grade. So what's your understanding of what scuttled this paper?
Well, I think there's been quite a lot of confusion in the media discussion of this story. And it's not surprising because it is quite confusing. Essentially, what happened is that civil society groups and non-government organizations have been asking the UN Office on Drugs and Crime to clarify their position on decriminalization of drug users, so the possession and use of drugs, possession of drugs for personal use and actual use of drugs, because a number of other UN agencies, including UNAIDS, the World Health Organization, UN Women, and the UN Development Programme, and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, have, over the last couple of years, all made very clear statements saying that criminalization of drugs, criminalization of drug users, is harmful to health and leads to human rights abuses. So the UNODC, in a way, even though it's the lead UN agency on drugs issues, was in fact the only UN agency that wasn't being clear in its position on decriminalization. So there was an incoherence between the different agencies. And so civil society groups were requesting that, given its lead role, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime clarify its position. And this has been going on for several years, in fact. And the UNODC had made a commitment almost 2 years ago that it would produce a statement on decriminalization. This statement has now emerged, and yes, it certainly did come from the HIV section within the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, who understandably are more pragmatic than many of the other sort of more diehard drug warriors within the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. But this, you know, it's not unusual for a department within a UN agency to offer advice, guidance, and briefing notes on a topic or area of policy and law that is their area of expertise. So the idea that any statement that comes out of the UNODC has to somehow be signed off by the executive director or the executive board of the UNODC is rather mistaken. However, this is a discussion that's been going on at the UN Office on Drugs and Crime for at least 2 years. This isn't something that's just sprung up spontaneously by some rogue operator within the UNODC. It's been discussed. It's been agreed. It was all set to be released yesterday at a harm reduction conference in Malaysia. And clearly a member state has got wind of it and put pressure on the UNODC to withdraw it. And the UNODC obviously is sensitive to member states. It's beholden to member states, not least the ones that fund it. So they've been put under pressure and they've withdrawn it. However, it is now in the public domain, and I think crucially the analysis within it is legally sound and evidence-based and you know, bulletproof from an argumentation point of view. So really, if the UNODC is going to try and backtrack on any of the actual content and detail of the document, they're going to have to produce arguments why what they've said is now not the case. And they won't be able to do that because it's evidently true, in as far as it's really just repeating stuff that either the UNODC has said previously or other UN agencies have said in recent years. So it's a very interesting, slightly complex situation, but the statement is now out there, and it is a UNODC statement, and it does call for the end of criminalization of drug users of all drugs globally, and makes a very clear and compelling evidence, human rights and law case for doing so.
So we don't know which of the member states scuttled this report or suppressed it. It's supposed to be a large member. Would that be the United States, do you think?
I mean, I think, you know, it's only speculation. We don't have any information on that, and we probably won't ever get any information on it. The UNODC, assuming that it did happen, aren't going to own up to it anyway. You know, UN agencies aren't ever going to say, oh, yes, we've just caved into pressure from a member state. But the kind of member states that can wield that pressure are either sort of the G7, the major sort of UN players, or they will be funding UNODC funding countries. So we can speculate. I think that the most likely candidate probably would be the US, but who knows? We don't know, and it's unlikely that we ever will know.
So you mentioned, Steve Rolls, the board, if you will, of the UNODC, the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime, that there are a lot of drug warriors within the top ranks of the bureaucracy. Can you explain further?
Well, I mean, I think you need the nature of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime needs to be understood, that this is a fundamentally prohibitionist entity, in that it oversees the three UN drug conventions, which are fundamentally prohibitionist legal instruments. The 1961 Single Convention on Drugs is the kind of founding legal document of the global war on drugs and the global prohibitionist regime, and has remained essentially unchanged since 1961. So it's been around for more than 50 years. So there is an entrenched culture within the UNODC that is very averse to any kind of legal or kind of spiritual, if you like, challenge to the kind of punitive ethos that underlies both the UNODC's work and the three treaties that form the bedrock of the UNODC as an institution. So whilst you have these other agencies, which like UNAIDS or the World Health Organization or the UN Development Programme or UN Women, that are tend to be more health and human rights oriented, and as a result, they tend to be more pragmatic and less kind of less sort of restricted by kind of historical inertia, if you like. The UNODC is historically it's been quite isolated from the rest of the UN system, and it's been its function is really to maintain global war on drugs rather than to protect the health and human rights of the citizens of the world, which is what the UN is there to do. The UN drug agencies are rather odd when viewed in the context of the other more pragmatic health and human rights driven agencies. So there's just a general default towards status quo positions and a resistance to change. And something like decriminalization, even though there is a very strong legal case and a very strong pragmatic case in terms of health and human rights outcomes, that criminalization is very counterproductive and decriminalization is a fundamental necessity to an effective HIV response and, effective health and human rights interventions, it goes against the grain of the punitive ethos that underlies the UNODC's core mandate. And so there's just a sort of default reluctance to go along with the general trend towards reform, which is happening within the UN, and it's obviously happening within the US, and it's happening across the world. The war on drugs is a sort of creaking institution that's in its dying days. But the UNODC, to a certain extent, represents the sort of last bastion of sort of bureaucratic drug war thinking. So when they are forced in a way to produce something, a statement like this on decriminalization, and a pragmatic quarter within the UNODC does produce it, you can understand that it's going to cause tensions both within the organization and within the prohibitionist member states who support the UNODC and want to maintain the status quo.
So what's the connection then here in the very title of the UN Office of Drugs and Crime? Obviously, they're lumping them together, which gives the impression that they're one and the same, but there's an awful lot of crime out there in the world. I'm not sure that the UN's doing much about it. A number of member states and the heads of member states are criminals. So
yes, well, absolutely. I mean, it's a massive problem because most people, including most people in the UN, view drugs as a health and social issue, and yet it is addressed within the UN under this Drugs and Crime Agency. When really it should be, if there was a UN agency that was dealing with drugs, it should be the UN Office on Drugs and Health. But it's not; it's crime. And the irony there, of course, is that it's the prohibition of drugs that has fueled most of the crime that's associated with drugs, because demand for drugs has continued to rise within a prohibitionist environment and all legal system. And all that does is create an opportunity for organized criminals. So in the 50 years that we've had this system, the single largest criminal commodity market on earth has evolved, and we now have an illegal drugs market that turns over more than $300 billion worth of illicit, highly risky substances every year. And it's completely unregulated, it's completely untaxed, it's controlled by often violent gangsters, and causes havoc and mayhem and crime and chaos across the world. So It's a profound irony of the institution and indeed the whole war on drugs paradigm that the response to drugs that we've chosen in terms of an enforcement response is actually creating the problem that the enforcement response is trying to deal with. It's complete idiocy, I think people are waking up to that now, and that the debate is certainly maturing, and the sort of critique analysis and some of the potential alternative approaches are now reaching the mainstream debate. And this UNODC document and the statements on decriminalization from the other UN agencies come at a very good time, because next year in April there is a UN General Assembly special session on drugs, which is a moment when the world leaders gather in New York at the General Assembly to discuss specifically issues around the war on drugs, whether or not it's working, and if there are alternatives that we should be looking at. Whilst the UNODC certainly hasn't made any comments on legalization of cannabis or anything else, the fact that they and other UN agencies have at least acknowledged that criminalizing users is counterproductive and must end is a very important step forward in an ever more mature debate.
So what's the possibility then of a bloc of nations getting together? Periodically, the Western Hemispheric nations meet, and every time they do have these summits, President Obama and his predecessors get an earful from the leaders of Latin America and Central American nations, whose countries are being ravaged by the war on drugs, particularly Mexico right next door. The former president of Mexico was one of the people that organized a group, and they had a joint letter that they wrote to the White House. So it's pretty clear that these nations get it in terms of the damage that the war on drugs does vis-a-vis the damage that drugs themselves do, and that it should be a matter of health as opposed to crime. In other words, the police should not be involved. The medical profession should be. After all, drugs are for sick people. So the whole notion of medicalizing the problem, unfortunately, semantically speaking, a lot of focus has been placed on the idea of either decriminalizing or legalizing, and those are political non-starters. So why hasn't the opponents of the war on drugs seized on this idea that, in terms of semantics, if you just explain that you're medicalizing it, taking it out of the hands of law enforcement and putting it in the hands of healthcare professionals, I think that resonates, doesn't it?
I think so. I think we need to make a distinction between how you might legalize or regulate different drugs. I mean, I think things like cannabis, I think, are relatively non-problematic. And as I'm sure you know, there's a number of U.S. states have already legalized and regulated non-medical use of cannabis. And the outcomes, certainly in Colorado and Washington, the other ones are only just getting started, but the outcomes are far from disastrous. And there's a lot of evidence emerging that actually the outcomes are rather good, that use isn't spiking and there hasn't been some kind of massive rise in sort of automobile accidents, and they're generating lots of tax revenue, and it generally seems to be being quite successful. But the approach that you'd have for cannabis is obviously very different to the approach you would have for, say, injectable heroin, where obviously that is something that needs to be dealt with in a much more strictly regulated environment, and probably a medical environment. But there are, you know, again, there are examples around the world of countries that have done that. In the UK, and there's been some limited experiments in Canada, much more extensively in Switzerland, you can get prescribed injectable heroin in a clinical setting, which you consume under supervision, and it's pharmaceutical grade, and no one's dying of overdoses, no one's contracting HIV, no one's committing any crimes to buy the heroin. You know, you're not funding terrorists in Afghanistan and all the rest of it. So we do have examples at either end of the scale, some of the less risky drugs like cannabis, and which should be regulated a bit more like alcohol and tobacco. And at the other end, you've got medical models for drugs like heroin, which can be regulated as they already are, as medical products, you know, within a sort of clinical setting. So there is already a certain amount of experimentation and evidence for how to do these things. And actually, when people do them, I mean, you say it's a political non-starter. I'd actually disagree with that. That when people do them, show some leadership on this, they are generally popular interventions. You know, and of course, the cannabis legalization movement in the U.S. has been driven by popular votes and ballot initiatives, and that there is now a majority support across the country for cannabis legalization. Cannabis legalization will only be the first step, but inevitably it will be the first because it's the most widely used and one of the less risky drugs. Obviously, it is associated with risk, but in relative terms, it's less risky. It's certainly less risky than alcohol or tobacco. So this is not a theoretical debate anymore. And it's not just the US. Uruguay has legalized and regulated cannabis as well, and a number of European countries are looking at it. Jamaica is moving down that road. So it's actually happening in a number of regions across the world. But you are absolutely right. A number of countries are very frustrated, particularly Latin American countries and Central American countries. They're frustrated with the obvious intolerable costs in terms of violence and instability and insecurity associated with the war on drugs. They fought this war on drugs sort of on behalf of the U.S. for decades, and the flow of drugs hasn't stopped. The U.S. is consuming as many drugs as it ever has, but these countries are carrying an undue burden of the costs of the failure of the policy, and they've had enough. And so they are the countries that are driving the debate at the U.N. level. They are, as you say, the countries that have called for the U.N. debate that's happening next year that I was talking about earlier. And it may well be that alliances amongst these countries are already forming. Informal alliances in the different regional entities at the UN and informally, they are forming alliances and they are trying to engineer a process of reform. But it's very difficult because if the big countries like the US and China and Russia and India, who hold sway in the international arena, aren't going along with it, it does make life very difficult for, I say, smaller countries. They're not all small. Some of them are huge, but some of the countries that don't have that kind of international heft. We are at a moment of sort of uncharted waters in terms of where the drug debate's at, both at a sort of political and public level, but also in terms of the high-level UN debate. There's an awful lot of tensions. It's clear that the kind of consensus around global prohibition is decisively broken. And it's not clear how things are going to pan out. But I think what is clear is that the status quo is now untenable and something has got to give. And that is going to happen soon. And I think it can only move in one direction, which is away, even if it's in an ad hoc and unstructured way, that we will see movement away from the more punitive war on drugs approach to dealing with the reality of drugs in society, because, we have to face the fact they are not going away. Drugs are here. Demand exists. It will be met one way or another. And if we don't provide some sort of regulated markets, then we know from history that an illegal market controlled by criminal entrepreneurs will always fill that void.
Well, Steve Rowles, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Steve Rowles, who's a senior policy analyst at the Transform Drug Policy Foundation, where he's the lead author on many of their publications, including 2009's After the War on Drugs, Blueprint for Regulation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.